From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Jeffrey Mason was once a Freudian therapist and project director of the Sigmund Freud Archives. Now he condemns Freudian therapy and all forms of psychotherapy. On today's Fresh Air, Mason compares the Freudian establishment to a cult group. Also today, we meet brothers Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez. For nearly a decade, they've collaborated on the adult comic book Love and Rockets. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg examines the difficulties of turning the written word into the spoken word. And critic Owen Gleiberman takes a second look at Can She Bake a Cherry Pie? It's a 1983 low-budget comedy about two people trying to find love in New York City. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush said today the treatment of American hostages in Iraq is uncivilized, and he called on the world to demand they be freed. The president spoke during a campaign rally in Minnesota. Joe Follansbee of Minnesota Public Radio reports.
The president said he wants a peaceful solution, but he said he would not tolerate Iraqi aggression. The president campaigned in Rochester, Minnesota this afternoon on behalf of Republican Senator Rudy Boschwitz. Speaking at a local high school, Bush called the alliance arrayed against Iraqi President Saddam Hussein fantastic.
And I will do my level best to hold that coalition together to see that these international sanctions work and that Iraq get out of Kuwait and without condition and free the people that they are holding in contravention of international law.
Bush said only America has the strength and commitment to push Hussein out. Bush also said it was okay for him to campaign for Republican candidates during the Persian Gulf crisis, just as the Democrats are doing. For National Public Radio, this is Joe Follansbee reporting.
Saudi Arabia today denied reports that hundreds of Yemenis have been beaten and tortured by its security forces. The allegations came from the London-based human rights organization Amnesty International. The Amnesty report charged that Yemenis have been arrested and mistreated because of their government's support for Iraq. The Saudi press agency quoted a government spokesman as saying that Saudi Arabia is prepared to receive an Amnesty team to investigate the charges. The Saudis say that they've withdrawn preferential treatment that was formerly given to Yemeni workers, but insist that Yemenis have not been mistreated. Emotions are running high in the North Carolina Senate campaign with charges and countercharges of outrageous lies, gay bashing, and racial slurs. NPR's David Malpas reports on the last-minute campaigning by Democrat Harvey Gantt and Republican Jesse Helms.
Pick a poll, any poll, in the North Carolina Senate race, and you're likely to be confused. Over the last 24 hours, two opinion surveys show Harvey Gantt with a narrow lead. A third poll has Jesse Helms out front, slightly. One poll indicates Gantt's support among whites is increasing. Another says it's eroding. Helms is emphasizing racial issues, charging that Gantt supports racial quotas. He's also labeled Gantt as a tax-and-spend liberal. The two themes seem to fuse well among those opposing Gantt.
We have 50% more people on welfare than we've ever had, and he looks like he wants to give everything away. He wants to give, and the government cannot support everybody.
Gantt says Helms is up to his old tricks, running a smear campaign that's designed to play on people's fears and prejudices. I'm David Malpas in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Stock prices closed substantially higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 36 points to close at 2,490.84. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jeffrey Mason, has reached the conclusion that all forms of psychotherapy are wrong and often diminish the patient's dignity and freedom. Mason used to be a member of the Freudian inner circle. As the project director of the Sigmund Freud Archives, he worked directly with Freud's daughter, Anna. But he challenged Freudian orthodoxy and went public with a letter by Freud that Anna wanted suppressed. It shook up the Freudian establishment. Mason was fired from his position at the Archives in 1981 and was drummed out of the psychoanalytic professional organizations he'd been a member of. Since then, he's written several books condemning Freudian theory and practice. Mason was the subject of a 1981 New Yorker profile by Janet Malcolm, which some readers regarded as revelatory and others saw as character assassination. Mason sued Malcolm for libel, charging that she misrepresented him by fabricating quotes. The Supreme Court has agreed to hear the case. Mason has a new book called Final Analysis about what it was like to undergo training as an Orthodox Freudian psychoanalyst. He says psychoanalysis is really a cross between a cult, a club, and a fraternity.
There is a cult-like atmosphere. There's a council of elders. There are ring bearers. There's reverence for the founder. There is, in fact, a founder. And as you might have guessed, I don't like gurus. There are legends passed on, and these legends are not just about Freud, but about other members. There is a conservation, attempt to conserve old values. There's secrecy. There's hazing. There are penalties. In my case, it was dismemberment. It's disbarment, and that's indeed what happened to me. And this is all very much like what goes on in a cult.
Why did you want to go into the field of psychotherapy in the first place?
Well, I believed that there was a great discovery by Freud, namely that sorrow thrives in secrecy and that nothing could be better than opening up this kind of thing. His original theories about ventilating sorrow, catharsis, seemed to me absolutely correct. And I thought psychoanalysis stands for some kind of deeper truth, that in psychoanalysis, form doesn't count, race doesn't count, sex doesn't count, background doesn't count, religion doesn't count, that it was the great leveler, that it had no ties, it was totally independent, it was the exercise of pure intelligence. And I discovered that that was not true.
When you were a student of Freudian analysis, you had to undergo analysis yourself. Did you see that student analysis as an initiation rite?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, what you learn there is really not to say the things that you honestly believe, because you can get yourself into great trouble. In fact, the very notion of telling somebody in the room what you really think about that person and expecting them to listen to that objectively without getting enraged at you is absurd. It doesn't happen in real life, and it doesn't happen in psychoanalysis. The only advantage, since you have absolutely no power in that situation and the analyst has all the power, the advantage for him is that he doesn't have to say how he feels. He can just turn red in silence. You can't even see him. And he may think to himself, I'll get that little SOB sooner or later.
When you were being screened by a therapist to see whether or not you would be good material to enter the school of psychoanalysis, one of the questions you were asked was, are you monogamous? And you thought that that was really an impossible question to deal with honestly in a situation that wasn't about your therapy, but was rather about your potential as a student and analyst. Is that typical of what you felt you were up against?
Well, yeah, I think that is typical. There are all kinds of unwritten rules, again, like in a sect. For example, you cannot be... Psychoanalysis really is a hymn of praise to mediocrity, so they don't allow people with revolutionary ideas into it. They are also homophobic, as you probably know, and they would not allow... If you were to say that you were homosexual, you would not be allowed to be trained in the American psychoanalytic institutes today. So that you have to be constantly on the qui vive not to say something that is going to anger them or make them decide that you don't have the potential for being an analyst. And it's not apparent to you at the time you're doing that. This is a corrupting experience.
What is the ultimate goal in Freudian analysis?
Well, it's difficult to say. There's an apocryphal statement that Freud said it's to be able to work and to love. But there's no direct statement to that effect. The only thing that Freud actually said was in 1895, and I used to think it was a marvelous phrase. I'm a little bit skeptical now, but he said the goal of analysis is to transform neurotic misery into common, ordinary human unhappiness. But it seems to me that to pay $150 every day, 5 days a week, for the next 10 years to learn that, I think you can just read Freud and save yourself a great deal of money.
There were lots of things that disturbed you about your analyst when you were going through psychoanalysis. I'd like to discuss a little bit of that. Can you tell the story of what he said about your wife, who you were discussing as being very intelligent but not conventionally beautiful, and you said that you were sometimes bothered by the fact that she wasn't beautiful and you found yourself being attracted to beautiful women?
Right. Well, I think, you know, this touched a sore spot for him in many ways, as one indeed always does with an analyst. There's something they're not going to be able to resonate to. And my, what they call the presenting symptom, it's a hateful term, was promiscuity. That is, I came in and I said, Dr. Schiffer, I've slept with more women than I should have, and I've never fallen in love, or very rarely. There's something wrong with me. And eventually he made the interpretation that the reason was I was not married to a beautiful woman. The reason I was finding monogamy so difficult is my wife wasn't beautiful. And he made some really horrendously sexist and speciesist comment about my wife. And I said, but this is your opinion. He said, no, it's your opinion. It's in your unconscious, and you just can't own up to it. You can't face this reality. And he said, look, I ought to know. I married. You married. He was constantly interpreting what was wrong with my wife as well. And he said, you see, the reason she's so intelligent, she was remarkably intelligent, woman. She's now a lawyer. And he said, is because she's displaced her envy of the penis into the brain. So instead of having a brain, she has a penis, a large penis in her head. That's why she's so smart. And it's because she's not beautiful. I ought to know. I did what any normal man should do. I married a beautiful but dumb woman. And your problem is you didn't do that. Now, this was outrageous at the time he said it. But he was constantly making interpretations of this kind. And when you're in that sort of powerless situation where you think this marvelous human being has some special insight into my soul, you think, well, maybe it's something that I have refused to face. Maybe I have denied this. I must look into myself instead of saying, you have no business saying things like that to anybody, let alone to a patient.
Yeah, but what I don't understand is that you really didn't think he was such a marvelous person. You thought that he was self-centered and that his insights were often totally off track, that he was manipulative, authoritarian. So why'd you stick it out?
Well, because when you're in that kind of one-down situation and you're unhappy and your life seems to be falling apart, you're not at your best to discern what's wrong with somebody. It's true that eventually I began to see a pattern with Schiffer. I began to see that I wasn't simply projecting these qualities from me onto him, that he really was a human being in his own right with all his many and obvious failings. But it took me a long time to see that. Now, remember also that I was in training, and he made it very clear from the first time I raised an objection to the language he was using against me. He said, look, if you go outside of this session and start telling people what I say here, I'm going to deny it, and you will not get any training. You'll be thrown out of the program. And I said, but that's blackmail. And he said, yes, but I'm doing it for your good. It's because nobody else in this city is able to treat you except me, so I'm going to keep you whatever it costs. And I was partly flattered, partly appalled, but I believed him for a short while. I thought he has some special insight into me. After all, he's, quote, a trained analyst. He's in his 60s. He's been doing this for 40 years. He must know something about me that I don't know. I was very wrong.
Jeffrey Mason is my guest, and he's the author of the new book, Final Analysis, The Making and Unmaking of a Psychoanalyst. You were briefly an analyst yourself. How did you like it?
I didn't like it. I found that I really did not have a talent. Let me make it clear, by the way, that I think there are some wonderful therapists and some wonderful analysts out there. I know I live with a therapist, but they are rare, and I believe that they're born, not trained, and it's very difficult to find one. The idea of an institute, for example, an institute for human kindness, is a kind of oxymoron. You can't train people to be kind or benevolent or compassionate. This is something, I don't know if people are born with it or learn it in their human relationships, but it's certainly not something you're taught in an institute, nor could you be.
Do you say you live with a therapist now?
I do, yes.
Well, what's their reaction to statements like yours that, you know, that all therapy is useless?
Well, she had some of these opinions before I started to live with her. And there are areas, of course, of disagreement. Remember that my argument is not with therapists, it's with therapy. And I believe that she, for example, is a warm and kind human being. Her name is Dady Donnelly. Not because of any training she had, but rather in spite of whatever training she had.
Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more. My guest is Jeffrey Mason, and he went from being a part of the inner circle of the Freudian establishment to believing that psychotherapy of any kind is wrong. His books include The Assault on Truth, Freud's Suppression of the Seduction Theory, Against Therapy, and a new book called Final Analysis, The Making and Unmaking of a Psychoanalyst. This is Fresh Air. Thank you. Jeffrey Mason is my guest. His latest book is Final Analysis, The Making and Unmaking of a Psychoanalyst. The most controversial action that you took while you were in the Freudian establishment had to do with Freud's seduction theory and a document that you found about it. So before we get into the letter that you discovered, describe what the seduction theory was and why Freud had abandoned it.
Well, this was Freud's early belief, and by early I mean 1896, that patients, many of the women who came to see him, in fact most of them, he said, had been sexually abused in early childhood. And he believed the women. And he thought, and I think he was right to think so, that he had made a revolutionary discovery and that he was, in fact, the first male to say this openly. And he gave a very brave paper on this called The Etiology of Hysteria in 1896 before his psychiatric colleagues. The response was ice. They simply froze him out. He was horrified by this. He expected to be received with great applause for them to say, what a courageous man you are to admit that these things go on, instead of which they walked out in silence. He wrote to his best friend the next day, a void is forming around me. The word has been given out to abandon me. Now, shortly thereafter, in fact, a year later, he did himself abandon the seduction hypothesis. He said he had been wrong. These male psychiatrists, but there were no women in the room, by the way, were right all along that there was no sexual abuse. It was all in the minds of his patients. That's called the abandonment of the seduction hypothesis. And Freud dates the beginning of psychoanalysis from that momentous decision that he had made a mistake. And our first knowledge of that mistake came in a letter that Freud wrote on September 21st, 1897, to his best friend Wilhelm Fliess. And that letter was published by Anna Freud. What she omitted, however, was a letter a few months later in which Freud said, I think I may have made a mistake. I'm beginning to believe that it is real and that it happens more frequently than I knew. And he gives there what is, in fact, his most elaborate clinical case history from the early days of a woman who was raped by her father when she was 2 years old, anally raped, nearly bled to death as a result of this. And at the end of this story, Freud has this tremendous outcry from his heart where he says, Wilhelm, I think we need a new motto for psychoanalysis. It should be, poor child, what have they done to you? Now that letter, and Anna Freud, I remember my shock when I noticed that Anna Freud had taken a red pencil and simply crossed it out and put not for publication. And I went to her with this letter that I now had the original of in my hand, and I said, Miss Freud, how could you omit something like this? This is one of Freud's great moments. In fact, it's one of the great moments in Western history. How could you omit it? And she said, well, he was wrong, as he later recognized, and it would simply confuse people to leave in a record like something like that in the record. And I showed my amazement at this reasoning, and she said, you see there, you are a member of the public and you are confused, so I was right to omit it. And I think that analysts were very upset when this record was put straight and we were able to see in context, and I published these letters eventually with Harvard University Press, to see the development of Freud's thought and to realize that there's more of a story around his abandonment of the sexual seduction hypothesis than we had been led to believe by the chroniclers of psychoanalysis. Something was not entirely right with this history.
Freud had many patients who claimed to have been sexually abused by adults. And after a while, he started thinking that they made it up.
That's right.
That it was fantasy.
That's right.
So he abandoned the theory that child abuse led to neurosis or hysteria.
That's correct.
Because he thought that these children weren't really abused. They were just imagining they were
That's
abused.
Right.
When you uncovered a letter about how he was having second thoughts about abandoning this theory, what reaction did you get from other analysts?
You see, the reaction was, this should be en famille. It's okay to talk about this between you and Anna Freud and Kurt Eisler and a few of the other analysts of the inner circle, but you mustn't allow the public to know about this, because it's going to encourage a certain skepticism about psychoanalysis. And my feeling was, then that skepticism is well justified. This must be known. There are any number of women who've come to analysts and psychiatrists in the years since Freud to talk about real abuse, only to be told it's only a fantasy. That always seemed to me wrong, but now here was direct evidence that Freud himself had doubts about this. I thought it should be put back in the record, and I couldn't understand why analysts were so terrified of this kind of information. Now, I did speculate as to why Freud might have done it, and I must say here that it is pure speculation. We simply don't know. I know that I would regard it as a failure of moral courage. I think he felt he couldn't possibly survive in Viennese medical society. People would not send him referrals. He would not. If he stood by the women, it would show enormous courage, but it wouldn't help him make a living. And I think that possibly unconsciously, I don't think he ever made the conscious decision, but I think he was under so much pressure that he finally caved in and decided to go along with what everybody else thought. And I think that was the beginning of the downfall of psychoanalysis. It's turning away from the real world.
Can you explain why there would have been pressure on Freud to disbelieve the women who told him that they were abused as children?
Well, for many reasons, think of it. At that point, women in Viennese society had absolutely no power. Secondly, he was saying this. Just think of where he announced it to the Viennese Psychiatric Society. Now, he was talking to only men in that room. There was no woman in there who could get up and say, you know, you're a right-on man, Sigmund, you're right. It happened to me and it happened to my sister. There was nobody to say that. There were no female researchers like Diana Russell today doing this extraordinarily important work that shows us how real sexual abuse is. So Freud had nobody in his audience but people who were either deeply skeptical for reasons of their own or who were themselves perpetrators, men who actually were abusing their children or other young children. Obviously, these were not the very people who were going to cheer Freud on in his search for some deeper truth.
You were reasonably comfortable, I think, being a member of the Freudian establishment. You were the head of the Freud archives until you were drummed out after the controversy over Freud's seduction theory. And I can't help but wondering how much of what you're telling us today is based on a vendetta against the Freudian establishment because of the way they reacted to you. And I say that because it wasn't until you were drummed out of the establishment that that you challenged everything, at least in a public way, the way you're doing now. And you're challenging, like, everything from top
right.
to bottom.
Sure.
And you've condemned the whole field of therapy altogether, Freudian and other kinds of therapy.
That's a good point. But let me remind you that I had actually published a number of articles which contained many of the same ideas I'm now saying, but that were published in standard analytic journals, and therefore the International Journal of Psychoanalysis. I wrote 3 articles to this effect. But since so few people read that, people didn't care. Analysts said, oh, well, so what? So Mason has these rather eccentric, revolutionary ideas about the reality of child abuse. What do we care? It's when, A, I found documents that showed that I wasn't simply barking in the night, that there was something real happening there, and that it was supported by actual letters by Freud himself and other material out of the archives in Europe, that they began to worry. And when the New York Times started writing about it, and they felt that he's reaching a wider public. Now, let me also remind you that in my last book, Against Therapy, where I talk about emotional tyranny and the myth of psychological healing, the subtitle, it was not only psychoanalysis that upset me. And remember, once I was no longer a psychoanalyst, I had still been trained, so I was perfectly entitled to practice psychotherapy and could easily have done so and made a very comfortable living. In fact, made 10 times what I make now as a writer. And the reason I decided against that was not because I couldn't do it or because of rancor at psychoanalysts, but because I believed it was wrong. And that's what I tried to explain in that rather unpopular book called Against Therapy. So I don't think it's true to say that I only did this as a vendetta. I did it because I really believed it was true. And I did it reluctantly and sadly. It was a comfortable living. To some extent, I like clubs, too. I don't belong to any and never would. But the idea of being with a group of people and being able to have friends that believe similar things that you do is something that attracts me. It still does. I'm just sorry I can't be a member of anything.
There are some schools of therapy that disagree with Freud just about as strongly as you do. And I think a lot of the feminist therapists surely reject the theory of penis envy as much as you do. Are you as distrustful of, say, feminist therapy and the schools of therapy that have turned against Freudian analysis? As you are Freudian analysis itself.
Well, you know, I would have said, if you'd asked me a few years ago, I would have said no. I would have said the feminists and the radical therapists are all moving in the right direction. Now I'm a little bit more skeptical. I must say that I am really deeply skeptical of anybody who claims to be an expert in your internal life. I simply believe they don't exist. It worries me that some feminists who have not been abused want to treat women who have been. I think it's very difficult to do that. Unless you've been there yourself, you can't really know what it's like. This is why I think self-help groups without professionals and without money passing hands is much better. And the great names in therapy do not fare very well in the light of objective knowledge. None of them. Freud, Jung, Binswanger, Pearls, Carl Rogers, Milton Erickson, John Rosen, Bruno Bettelheim. Now, we notice that most of those are men, it's true. And I was hoping initially that women would change this. But I think the extent to which women buy into this larger system, and here I'm thinking of the work of Catherine MacKinnon and Andrea Dworkin, who've made me aware of this kind of disaster that happens when women buy into, they use the term patriarchy. But I think there's some truth to that. They are then forced to adopt a lot of the ideas that their instincts would tell them are not right. And I'm worried that feminist therapists, I would almost say that that's a contradiction in terms. You can't be both a feminist and a therapist. There's something about therapy that is anti-feminist.
You mean because it's authoritarian?
It's not. It is authoritarian. It also tends to blame the victim. It tends to look inside when it should be looking outside. It says things like, what have you done to bring this on? Otherwise, it's not really therapy. As so many women have pointed out, you know, when a therapist says, well, what were you doing to make your husband hit you? And the woman says, I wasn't doing anything. I was just standing within reach of his arm. And of course, they then can't. The therapist must think to himself or herself, well, what can I do about that? I can't get rid of her husband. I can't give her shelter. I can't give her food or money to help her. So all I can do is interpret. And that's really not what those women need.
I have to tell you that I know a lot of people who've been in and out of therapy over the years, and some of them felt it didn't help much, but others felt that it helped them quite a bit. And I can't believe that you've never met anybody who feels that they were helped by therapy. And if you have met people who feel that they were really helped by therapy, how can you believe that therapy is totally and completely useless?
Well, there's no doubt that people have been helped and have told me that. And I would say about half the people I meet tell me it was wonderful and the other half say it was terrible. But what I'm concerned with is that when you go into therapy, you are giving your consent and that your consent be informed. And to be genuinely informed, we have to know a great deal more than we now know about the other side of therapy. After all, if you walk into any good bookstore in America and go to the section on psychology or psychiatry, there are literally hundreds of books that will tell you how wonderful it is. There are very few books that will warn you of the dangers. And that's what frightens me. That my great objection is that psychiatry seems to have a fear of taking, and psychoanalysis too, even psychology, a fear of taking an unsentimental, an unflinching look at their own past.
Jeffrey Mason, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Jeffrey Mason, his new book is Final Analysis, The Making and Unmaking of a Psychoanalyst. Next time, the composer of the songs Old Devil Moon and How About You, Burton Lane. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Love and Rockets is a comic book, but don't expect to find it with the kid stuff. It's not just the sex that keeps it in the adult section, it's the stories. Superhero fans probably wouldn't be interested in these character studies. Coming up, we meet the creators of Love and Rockets, Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez. 100 years ago, reading aloud was a common family recreation. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg examines how literature translates from the page to the voice today. And critic Owen Gleiberman reviews the home video of the romantic comedy Can She Bake a Cherry Pie? Owen says this 1983 low-budget comedy is Annie Hall taken to a further stage of neurosis. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. The White House says that President Bush will visit U.S. troops in the Persian Gulf for Thanksgiving. The president will travel to the Middle East after a trip to Paris for a conference there on security and cooperation in Europe. Mr. Bush will also make stops in Prague and Germany before going on to Paris. Secretary of State James Baker has revised his travel plans to make a trip next week to Moscow. And he also has a date in Cairo with China's foreign minister. Barry Schwide reports.
Baker is going ahead with a swing through the Persian Gulf and Europe, trying to consolidate support for the more muscular posture the Bush administration is taking toward Iraq. But now he has added Moscow to see Soviet President Mikhail Gorbachev, and in Cairo he'll meet with Chinese Foreign Minister Chen Shih-chun. Soviet and Chinese approval is essential for any moves the U.S. would take against Iraq through the U.N. Security Council. Baker also has some arms control business to do with Soviet Foreign Minister Edward Shevardnadze, wrapping up the final details of a treaty to cut NATO and Warsaw Pact weapons in Europe. Administration officials say there is no timetable for military action to force Iraq out of Kuwait, but Washington war talk this week has given a note of urgency to Baker's 8-day mission. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
Armed clashes in the Soviet Republic of Moldavia have claimed at least 6 lives and left 30 others injured. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Today's deaths were the first since a recent wave of tensions in the Southern Republic, where ethnic minorities are demanding freedom from Moldavian rule. The official TASS news agency said today's battle involved police and armed civilians. TASS did not make clear the ethnic identities of those involved. The fighting began near the town of Dubasari in a predominantly Russian-speaking territory, which has proclaimed its independence from Moldavian rule. The Russian speakers charged that the republic's ethnic Moldavian leadership discriminates against minority populations. Another minority group, the Gagauz, are also claiming independence from Moldavia. The republic's government has rejected that claim and declared a state of emergency in Gagauz territory. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
For the second day, thousands of people demonstrated in Bucharest against price increases and the lifting of price controls. Some of the protesters shouted anti-government slogans as they marched. The government has said that price increases will affect only wholesale expenses and will not immediately affect basic products such as coal, food, and children's clothing. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up 36 points to close at 2,490.84 in active trading. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. A lot of people don't have time to read books anymore, but they'd like to be read to. Reading aloud is enjoying a revival. Linguist Jeffrey Nunberg shares some thoughts on this art.
You mightn't think it, but Sloppy is a beautiful reader of a newspaper. He do the police in different voices. That was Betty Higdon's summary recommendation of Sloppy, her young charge in Dickens' Our Mutual Friend. T.S. Eliot made the line famous when he used it in an early version of The Wasteland. The 19th century was the last great age of reading aloud. Women read to one another while they were doing their sewing. Families read to one another after supper. Cigar makers and tailors paid apprentices to read to them at work. It was a natural occupation in a time when books and candles were expensive, when literacy was limited, and when home entertainment was a do-it-yourself affair. We have livelier ways to spend our evenings now, but reading aloud will never entirely disappear, I think. That's how we first encounter books, after all, and the pleasure of being read to has an almost primordial hold on us. Of course, the circumstances have changed a bit since Dickens' time. Nowadays, the main venue for reading aloud is the highway, not the hearth, and the texts come to us courtesy of public radio or books on tape. But what's changed most is the texts themselves. 19th century literature was made for reading aloud, sometimes quite consciously. Dickens' daughter described seeing her father recite his dialogue into a mirror before writing it down. Maybe that's why Dickens' prose is reader-proof, the way some plays are said to be actor-proof. It can be read by an American or an Englishman, by a man or a woman. It can be mumbled or declaimed, and it always has the same dense exuberance. But apart from Dr. Seuss, most modern authors don't write with live voices in mind. This doesn't mean that modern fiction can't be read aloud, but the process calls for a certain diffidence. It's a delicate business, and readers sometimes get it wrong. For example, listen to Carrie Nye reading an Ann Tyler story called Average Waves and Unprotected Waters in a series of radio programs called Selected Shorts.
Arnold sat by the window. He must have thought he was going to work with her when they passed the red and gold cresses sign. He jabbered and tried to stand up. "No, honey," she said, and took hold of his arm. He settled down then and let his hand stay curled in hers a while. He had very small, cool fingers and nails as smooth as thumbtack heads. At the train station, she bought the tickets and then a packet of Wrigley spearmint gum. Arnold stood gasping at the vaulted ceiling with his head flopped back and his arms hanging limp at his sides. People stared at him. She would have liked to push their faces in.
This is also thespian, the sententious tremor and dying falls, the artful pauses, as if Nye were waiting for the words to come to her. It's as if she feels she has to do Ann Tyler, like one of those one-person shows where Hal Holbrook does Mark Twain or Julie Harris does Emily Dickinson. But Tyler's prose already has a voice, as plain and homey as Maryland soft-shelled crabs, and Nye serves it up like lobster Thermidor. This is a problem that a lot of actors have when they read aloud. They seem to feel that their public expects them to perform the text. The biggest trap is the dialogue. Here are all these characters just waiting to be brought to life, and few actors can resist the temptation to turn a novel into a radio play. For example, listen to what Judith Ivey does with a dialogue in her recording of Bobby Ann Mason's novel, In Country.
"I have to stop again, hun," Sam's grandmother says, tapping her on the shoulder. Sam Hughes is driving, with her uncle, Emmett Smith, half asleep beside her. "Where are we?" grunts Emmett. "Still on I-64. Mama has to go to the restroom." "I forgot to take my pill when we stopped last," Mama says. "You want me to drive now?" Emmett asks, whipping out a cigarette.
This is the school of reading that Sloppy specialized in, doing the police in different voices. It's fine for the Police Gazette or for a children's story, as in, "Not I," said a little red hen. But here it's a little distracting. On the page, a novelist can suggest a voice or accent with a word or turn of phrase, but when it's fleshed out like this, it can become a kind of caricature. Actually, authors are often the best readers of their own work. They usually assume that the job of storytelling is done when the last line of the manuscript's been typed, so that reading it aloud should be a purely mechanical transaction. Actors sometimes speak disparagingly of performers who merely mail in their lines, but from the author's point of view, that can be a virtue. For example, I like the way Ann Beattie reads her novel Remembering Will on cassette. At first, her voice sounds flat and affectless, but then it recedes entirely so that you have the feeling of the storytelling itself.
As his mother and Havabud sat on the front step of a brownstone, looking at small rectangular images, Will was in Virginia staring at a peanut butter sandwich Mary Vickers had served him. He had peeled the top piece off to compare with Wag the number of banana slices each had been allocated. Havabud's lips, smacking with pleasure as he surveyed the photographs, were echoed across the miles by the sticky lips of two small boys who had been told to place the bread back on the sandwich instantly and to begin eating before Mary Vickers went stark raving mad.
In fact, I have to confess that I prefer hearing Ann Beattie to reading her. The artlessness of her voice makes a nice counterpoise to the artifice of her prose. Max Beerbohm once said that the task of a written style is to compensate for the absence of a physical voice. All the effects that the voice can achieve with accent, tone, and pacing, the stylist has to bring off with words alone. That's why a reader who supplies too much of the absent voice can unwittingly deprive a style of its very reason for being. It's just one more vindication of the universal aesthetic principle that I first heard articulated by a New York barfly named Ray the Horse. Don't romance me, just pour the drink.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford University and the Institute for Research on Learning in Palo Alto, California. This is Fresh Air. American kids who grew up reading comics were told by their parents they'd outgrow them, but instead the comics grew up along with their readers. In the 60s and 70s, underground comics offered offbeat, idiosyncratic ideas in comic book form. The past decade brought a new wave of adult comics, often referred to as graphic novels. My guests Gilbert and Jaime Hernandez are an important part of that new wave. They are two Mexican-American brothers who grew up in an ethnically mixed neighborhood outside of Los Angeles. Since 1981, they've been doing a comic book series called Love and Rockets. Each edition includes stories by both Jaime and Gilbert. Jaime's stories are about men and women who came of age with the anarchy of punk rock, like Jaime did. Gilbert's stories are often based on tales his family told him about life south of the border. The stories are set in an imaginary town called Palomar.
When I started the Palomar stories, Jaime had already been doing his stories about young people living in the United States, particularly Hispanics, and I decided, well, you know, instead of do the same thing, I said I'll do the stories from the other side of the border's point of view, just to make things different for the book. And it actually liberated me from actually repeating what Jaime was already doing.
Now, Jaime, describe where your stories are set.
Pretty much where I grew up, you know, Southern California, Mexican neighborhood. It's just pretty much the Southern California that the media and TV and movies never show you. That, yes, not all of us go surfing and wear sunny, bright clothes and things like that and are blonde.
But not all of us are in gangs either.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Do you want to describe the early stories in which the characters you do now originated?
When we first started the comic, I was just throwing everything in there that I had planned before we were doing this professionally. And I pretty much was going along with it, you know, not knowing where anything was going. And so I had a lot of spaceships and robots and dinosaurs and things like that mixed in. But as we kept going along, we got better response to the characters, which I like doing. And when I found out that people were willing to put up with just normal people, I jumped right in there.
One thing you both have in common is that you often tell stories from the woman's point of view. And I wonder why you both do that, being men.
Well, I can't tell you why either. I just like doing it, and it just worked out. I mean, we got really good response from female readers.
A lot of what we originally put, and still do in Love and Rockets, was we put things in because we weren't seeing them anywhere else. As far as popular, you know, entertainment goes, I mean, you could pick up a novel and you know, read about great, you know, female characters, but you couldn't go to the movies or put on a TV show or whatever, and there weren't, at the time, this is the early 80s, there weren't just too many great female characters going on. There still aren't, enough of them, of course. There's more on TV than there are in films. But anyway, we just decided to emphasize that because that was something we had a knack for. I mean, you know, it's not perfect or anything. We get a lot of letters from women saying, oh, a woman wouldn't do that and this and that, and, which is, you know, good, keeps us on our toes. But it just seemed like women had more interesting things to say in certain areas. And this is the truth. And they're just a lot more fun to draw.
More fun to draw?
Yeah. And not just the sexy ones. I mean, all the women, you know, they're just more fun to draw because they use body language differently than men do. Guys are pretty boring to draw sometimes because they just stand there, have their hands in their pockets or something, where the women are usually more just interesting in their body language.
Was it ever any more difficult than it might have been otherwise to get published when you were drawing comics with, you know, characters making love to each other? And Jaime, in your case, some of those characters making love to each other are women. You know, there's like lesbian characters in it. So was there ever any problems with bookstores carrying it or with a publisher publishing it because of that?
Actually, it was easier in the beginning, but now, I don't know, with this censorship scare, everyone's running around like a maniac. Every once in a while, a book will be stopped at a border somewhere, you know, in another country. But our first real big response against nudity or anything was because Gilbert drew a naked man dancing. And, you know, we had naked women, you know, long before that. But as soon as the man was showing genitalia, you know, they just went crazy.
The much-celebrated double standard.
Yeah.
Do you think women ever distrust a man doing lesbian scenes in his work? You know, because I think a lot of women feel that men who are into lesbianism are into it in a really voyeuristic way.
Exactly. Some people are. They're usually afraid to tell me to my face. But, you know, but then at the same time, I get really good response saying that I'm treating everything really fairly. And you know, then once in a while, I'll get a response from a lesbian saying, well, that's not how they do it. And it's like, well, how is there only one way to do it, you know, to show it?
It seems most unusual to have two brothers who are both comic book artists. Do you have any explanation for how you both ended up being talented at this?
Oh, we started that since we learned to draw, because mm-hmm. there were always comic books in the house, so that was a pretty easy way to, you know, tell a story.
Did you ever?
It was something always in us, even when we were small children, that that we wanted to tell stories. It was always our desire to tell stories with words and pictures, and comics were the best way to do it. And I say, and the way things are going now, it's still one of the best ways of doing it.
What do you mean, the way things are going now?
Oh, just how most Hollywood movies are pretty bad. Same with television. I mean, you come up with a character, like, say, if Jaime took Maggie and Hopi to do it to be a, you know, television characters, they'd go like, this is great, but do they have to be lesbians? You know, that sort of thing.
Right.
It gets watered down to the point where we just say, the hell with it. In a comic book, you know, in the particular kind of comic books we do, it's like we'll do anything we want when we want to do it. And we have nobody on our backs telling us we can't. And I think that's why there's so much interest in alternative comic books nowadays.
Your mother collected comics, right?
Yeah.
So what kind of comics did you read when you were growing up? All kinds or certain kinds?
Yeah, we read all kinds of comics, and I think that's why nobody can really pinpoint our influences. We read them all. I mean, we read the Marvel DC superhero comics, but we also read, kiddie comics like Little Dot or Richie Rich or those types. And we read Mad Magazine. We read Dennis the Menace comics. I mean, just anything that that came in the house. You know, it was almost like we had no taste, so we just having no taste might be better than having bad taste, because at least having no
that.
Taste, you absorb everything. Whereas having bad taste, you only take in a certain amount, right?
That's a very interesting way to look at it.
Well, you know, because little kids, you know, you're like, it's like a little ball of clay and you mold it, right? So we just, you know, we took in as much of the good that we, you know, that we could figure out, and hopefully eliminated the bad. I mean, you know, that doesn't always work. I mean, sometimes some of our bad influences creep into our work, but you know, it's a challenge to keep them out.
One of you once said that you used to get beaten up a lot when you were young. Was there a special reason that you were picked on?
Well, it was more picked on, not necessarily beaten up, but picked on. I don't know. I just kind of a geeky type person, you know, didn't like sports. Just you know, everybody's got a story like that. You know, everybody was picked on. You know, I mean, most people were. What's funny is that everybody says they were picked on. I go, well, then who's doing the picking? You know?
Really? Yeah.
Like all of a sudden, all these yuppie bonehead jocks going around saying, "Oh, I was picked on as a kid." And I go, "What are you talking about? You were the guy beating Mia." Yeah. You know? All of a sudden, everybody's a sensitive, you know, person nowadays. It's like it's a hoax.
Does your mother, who used to read a lot of comics, I don't know if she still does or not, but does your mother read your comics, and has she given you any feedback that was useful to you?
Well, I think she reads my stuff more than Gilbert's. I think his stuff scares her.
Gilbert, do you agree?
She never says anything. Sometimes I'm really surprised that she'll mention something that, you know, that I did in an issue or something. And I go, "Oh, you read that issue? Because that issue also had this and that," meaning, you know, some sticky violence or sex in it, you know. And I just, you know, I lay awake at night thinking, "My mom saw that, yay," you know. This is my Catholic guilt creeping up on me. But she doesn't say anything because I think she trusts us. I think she's very proud of us that we've gone this far. Because to be honest, we never thought we'd get this far, that anybody would be that interested in what we wanted to say.
What kind of scene do you worry scares her?
Oh, just in my stories, just explicit sex scenes, basically. I mean, you know, nobody's mother wants to see their child drawing people doing the Humpty Dance, you know? It's just it's just something, you know, and I understand. I'll probably feel the same way when I've got kids, you know, and they're drawing people doing that, you know. Jaime has a more easygoing attitude about his stories that are easier to get into, I think, whereas mine has a darker tone, and that's not because I'm trying to be creepy or anything, but I guess I'm just pessimistic.
Thanks a lot for talking with us.
Oh, it's our pleasure.
No problem.
Jaime and Gilbert Hernandez. Their comic book, Love and Rockets, is published quarterly by Fantagraphics Press in Seattle. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Hi, Linda.
Hi, Terry. We're talking today with some women who have been invited by Saddam Hussein to go to see their husbands in Iraq, people who are being held as human shields, visiting with people who've decided they do want to do it and people who've decided they do not. We also are talking again about politics today, Terry, as the election moves closer and closer. Republican women are undecided in a number of states like Texas, Iowa, Minnesota, and how they make up their minds could very well determine the outcome of the elections in those states. There's been more ethnic violence in Moldavia, and we will be looking into that as well.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Director and writer Henry Jaglom has made half a dozen independent comedies in the past decade. They include Sitting Ducks, Always, and New Year's Day. Paramount Home Video is now giving a wide video release to all of them. Critic Owen Gleiberman reviews one of his favorite Jaglom films, Can She Bake a Cherry Pie?
Remember that scene in Woody Allen's Manhattan where Allen and Diane Keaton run into Keaton's ex-husband, Jeremiah? She's been describing him as a sexual paragon, but he turns out to be a hyperkinetic intellectual played by Wally Shawn. Well, if someone had made an entire movie about his relationship with Keaton, it might have turned out something like Henry Jaglom's Can She Bake a Cherry Pie? As a director, Jaglom is like a hybrid of Woody Allen and Andy Warhol. Can She Bake a Cherry Pie was semi-improvised and made on the slimmest of shoestring budgets. Like Jaglom's other movies, it consists mostly of people sitting around living rooms and cafes, gassing on about their problems. This sort of thing drives a lot of critics up the wall. Yet I've always had a soft spot for Jaglom. His characters are as self-indulgent as can be, but at least they do talk. Can She Bake a Cherry Pie was made in 1983, yet it's really a time capsule movie rooted in the 70s. Karen Black plays Z, a frazzled amateur nightclub singer who's just been abandoned by her husband. That's probably the best explanation for why she starts dating Eli, a middle-aged Manhattan businessman played by Michael Emile. Visually, Emile suggests a balding, 60-year-old chimpanzee, and when he talks, which is all the time, he's like a cross between a Talmudic scholar and a California Zen freak. Here he is advising a friend on how to meet women.
You ought to relate to women in a more natural way, in a less self-conscious and pre-directed manner. You shouldn't go with the purpose of achieving this or that. You should just let the relationships develop and happen as they do by the accidental circumstances of life. That's what I do. You're asking my advice, so the only thing I can say is what I do myself. I don't go picking up somebody. I just meet people naturally and talk to them naturally. If something develops, it does. If it doesn't, there's no way to force it to develop.
It's no accident Emile has appeared in nearly all of Jaglom's films. He's the director's older brother. He isn't an actor, exactly. He's more like a found object, a man so compulsively cerebral, he's little more than a brain on legs.
I'm sorry. I don't want to make you feel uncomfortable in any way.
Oh, it's not you. I think you're very nice. Kind of funny, but very nice.
Kind of funny? Would you like to elaborate on that?
Well, you seem to have a lot of energy, and it gets stuck in your forehead.
Gets stuck in my forehead?
Yeah, it kind of comes out and goes right here, you know? It's like thinking instead of flowing. You stop it.
Do you ever have the experience that people tell you they don't quite understand what you're saying?
Can She Bake a Cherry Pie is like Annie Hall at a further stage of neurosis. Eli and Z are so terminally self-conscious, their relationship plays like a cracked parody of romance. In one of the funnier scenes, the two are going at it in the sack, and Eli has himself wired to a pulse monitor. He says that if his heartbeat gets quick enough, he'll know he's truly in love. Jaglom's style has the same virtues and irritations that Warhol's did. When the actors have something to say, the movie can seem refreshingly truthful and low down. At other times, it just rambles. But at least the rambling serves a purpose. Jaglom is mercilessly satirizing these navel-gazing characters. Are they a pain? Absolutely. That's the whole point. In Annie Hall in Manhattan, Woody Allen captured the odd glories of an era in which people spent as much time analyzing their relationships as they did living them. Watching Henry Jaglom's films, you understand why that era had to end.
Owen Gleiberman is film critic for Entertainment Weekly. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, the composer of the songs How About You, Old Devil Moon, and On a Clear Day, we talk with Burton Lane. And reporter Stefan Salisbury examines the future of the National Endowment for the Arts. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.